The Guardian.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, Naomi Harris is a British A-lister going back to school in the first grader. I'll be talking to her about her role as a courageous teacher in rural Kenya, confronted with an 80-year-old former soldier with a passion to learn. And we'll be discovering how British director Kevin MacDonald took a cinematic snapshot of the world with his film A Life in a Day. I'll be finding out from Kevin how he got to play God directing this unique project. Zan Brooks will be here to review some of the week's other releases, including Mel Gibson taking a furry hand puppet to his heart in The Beaver, Catherine Deneuve fighting misogyny and playing it for laughs in François Ozon's comedy Potiche, and Woody Harrelson proving it's never good to bring bad news in The Messenger. Yes, it's cinematic life in a podcast. It's Film Weekly. Naomi Harris has slowly built a reputation as one of the most versatile actresses of her generation. From TV adaptations such as Zadie Smith's White Teeth and Andrea Levy's Small Island, to Hollywood blockbusters like Pirates of the Caribbean, and British indies including 28 Days Later, and Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, Naomi has brought a grace and intelligence to every part. That combination was never more needed than for her latest role as Teacher Jane in The First Grader, the story of a Kenyan schoolmistress who fights to keep hold of an unusual pupil, an 80-year-old man, Marunge, whose remaining ambition it is to get an education. Fresh from her stint on stage in Danny Boyle's Frankenstein, I met up with Naomi Harris to ask about her work in The First Grader. But before we hear that conversation, let's listen to her in Kenya.
Marunge, what are you doing here? Come inside.
I took the oath to get our land back from the British.
But okay. You don't have to tell me this.
I worked on a white man's farm. Then came the fight for freedom.
But okay.
Have a letter.
What do you mean?
That's why I came to the school. I must read it for myself. I have to understand. Please, teach me to read, Mrs. Obichu.
Naomi, thank you so much for joining me again on Film Weekly. Always lovely to have an opportunity to get you on as well, because it means that you're in something and on the big screen as well, so it's doubly exciting. And it is wonderful to see a film about Africa on the big screen here in London. There just aren't enough opportunities to see it. It's almost a shame that it had to be sort of a BBC crew that made this film. It's not an indigenous African story. I want to talk about your experience of working there, working with an African crew, an African cast as well, African children. Just it must have been, it looks like it was wonderful. It looks like you're really enjoying it, because I think it's this, if I may say, I know it's one of your biggest parts, but I think you're fantastic in it, and you really kind of it seems to bring out the best in you.
Well, I absolutely loved the experience, and it was great for me. And it doesn't really matter that it's, like, you know, partly funded by the BBC, in terms of, you know, it's still so authentically African. And one of the things that I love about it is that, you know, it's a really positive, uplifting story that's coming out of Africa. And so often we get stories coming out of Africa about genocide and poverty, and it's not one of those. You know, it is really got a universal message, and it's inspiring. You know, you leave feeling uplifted by it, rather than, you know, wanting to bash yourself over the head and think, oh my god, what an awful person I am. You know, and it was a great experience, you know, working in Africa. It was extraordinary working with those children in particular, because the story was behind it was that Justin asked me to get my...
It's Justin Chadwick, the director.
Yeah, Justin Chadwick, our director, asked me to get my African, well, my Kenyan accent all up to scratch before I even left London.
Do you have sort of accents in a little box in your room somewhere?
I wish it were as simple as that, and I could just open one box and inhale, yeah, Kenyan accent today, inhale it. No, it's not as simple as that. No, I had to have... there were no Kenyan accent coaches, but I worked with a Kenyan lady who was over here in London, and she, it was just a matter of imitating her, basically, and then annoying my friends and family by doing the accent all the time.
Go on, give us a little one.
I can't now. No, don't put me on the spot like that. I can't remember anything. It's a long time ago now. Do you know, it's like over 2 years ago. So, yeah, I could do other accents, but not that. I can inhale other boxes. Anyway, but the point was that I had to have my Kenyan accent already in the bag. And then he introduced me to this school as a local Kenyan woman and as Teacher Jane. And then I was given a classroom full of kids, my kids, who ranged, there were 80 children, who ranged in age from 5 to 21. And I had to teach them every day for 2 weeks and come up with lesson plans. And they saw me as Teacher Jane, as their teacher. And so I had a real responsibility to teach these children, educate them, and be a responsible teacher, a good teacher. So it was a terrifying experience.
So they had no idea that you were Naomi Harris from 28... Well, they wouldn't know from 28 Days Later, or White Teeth, or maybe Pirates of the Caribbean.
None whatsoever. These children are from a very remote, rural, poor farming communities. And so they've never seen film before, never seen TV before, which is why, you know, in the film you get these wonderful close-ups, you know, really, really close with these children's faces. The camera's right next to their faces. And they don't care at all. They're not bothered because they don't have any concept of TV and film. So this camera doesn't mean anything to them at all. And so, yeah, they have no idea about, you know, it was kind of like an episode of Passing Off or whatever it's called. What's that show called?
Faking it.
I was faking it as a local Kenyan teacher.
You any good?
Yeah. I think they bought it.
Did you have any teaching breakthroughs? You know, like when you're teaching kids and you suddenly see them kind of maybe they're doing their ABC or they're writing something. Did you think, my God, I should have been a teacher?
I did think I should have been a teacher, actually. Yeah, I was like, in another life, I'd love to do this. Or maybe after when, you know, later on in my acting career, when it's all starting to quieten down or something, I'll go into teaching because it's so rewarding, you know. It's one of the most rewarding things there is. It's like, you know, I'm not a mother, but I can imagine that, you know, being a mother is hugely, you know, satisfying experience. And it's kind of like that, but times by 80, you know, getting to see the joy and the transitions of all these children. It's an amazing experience.
So you were in a remote rural part of Kenya. Do you know where, can you tell us where it was?
It was in Kisamis in the Rift Valley.
And had you ever been there?
No, I've never been to Kenya before, no.
Yeah. Had you been to Africa?
Yeah, I filmed in South Africa, did Blood and Oil in South Africa. Oh. The very first film that I ever filmed was called Anansi, which was in Ghana. And then I've been to Nigeria because I've got lots of Nigerian friends, yeah.
And the sort of enormity of, obviously you're a British actress, they could have cast a local actress. Was there any sort of feeling from you, perhaps, that you were like, you know, why are they using me?
Probably I must have a huge ego because I never thought that. I never thought, why me? The only points where I thought that was like when I started to teach the kids, and because their main language is not English. And so it was very difficult in the beginning to be able to communicate with them because I had to learn some Swahili, little phrases of Swahili to be able to communicate. But to really break through and get a relationship with them was really tough in the beginning. And at those points I thought, gosh, if only I really were Kenyan and I could speak the language, it would be amazing.
I'm not saying that, you know, that there are casting issues, because obviously the man, your main man in the film, who's wonderful, and it is a local man, and he is a discovery that we've had. He was a newsreader, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He was a newsreader, and they searched for like 6 months to find, you know, somebody who could play this part of Maruge, because he's a real iconic figure in Kenya.
The real Maruge is well known, is he?
Yes, very much so, very much so. I mean, look, most schools will have a picture of him because he's hugely inspirational. You know, this man who at 84 changed his life completely and went on to, get an education. He got to fifth grade before he died at the age of 89. He went to the UN and spoke about the importance of education. So he's hugely inspirational figure in Kenya, and most children will know about him and adults as well. So to find someone to play him was really tough for, you know, Justin, and they searched for 6 months to find him, and they found someone who they thought was fantastic, but because of the age, you know, he has to be an older gentleman, this man wasn't able to pass his medical. And so they couldn't use him, which was a real shame. So they were like, ah. So I think it was like, I mean, it was like something like I think it was like 5 weeks before they started shooting, and they still hadn't found him. And then they heard about this newscaster, Oliver Letondo, who was in this remote village. And he didn't have a phone, didn't have internet, so they had to send someone from the local village to go to a sweet shop or what have you to send out the word to get Oliver. Then he got on a bus and he drove for 6 hours to get to Nairobi. I mean, it was like... crazy story. But thankfully it all worked out, because Justin said as soon as he saw him, he just realized that was the guy to play.
It's a crazy story, but it is just an African story, really. And I kind of like that. That's what is there in this continent, and I think that so many stories are untold or not told. And as you said, even when we do see ones that are West inflected, they're either Constant Gardener or they're the Blood Diamond, there is a kind of social aspect to it. Not usual that they are positive ones. And we are seeing a certain kind of positivity reflect that. There was a documentary recently called A Small Act about Chris Mburu, who went back to Kenya and kind of poured back, was trying to show the educational kind of benefit that happened to him. Mm. These stories are coming out of Africa, but it is difficult to do a positive story. Is it difficult to be in one and not go the kind of full violins and or chora, I suppose, that really kind of turn up the sentimentality of it? Because it is so inspiring that one, in a way, I feel you have to kind of just let it happen and downplay it almost to kind of stop the lacrimosity of it.
I think that's very true, actually. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I'm not really responsible for that, but Justin is, and the editors are. And I think they did a fantastic job with that. And I think one of the ways that they do that is by introducing humour. There's a lot of humour in the film, and I think that's a brilliant way of making sure that it doesn't get too overly sentimental. You know, you laugh for yourself and laugh at the situation, and I think that works brilliantly. And actually, that wasn't really, a lot of that humour wasn't really in the original script. It was introduced by Justin because he noticed that, like, particularly on the local radio stations, there was this great figure, a radio figure, and he would make a lot of the people laugh, and so he introduced that character into the script, and lots of the stuff was improvised or Justin heard, you know, while he was out and about, and he would write down, and then he introduced it to the script.
They do make you laugh. I mean, they're kind of amazing, these kids, assuming filming with them was kind of a mix of kind of, you know, horror, as you say. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do with them, how am I going to talk to them? And they just must have been hilarious to look at.
They were hilarious, yeah. I mean, they just had you in stitches the whole time. But it was really interesting, actually, because in the beginning, it wasn't like that at all. It was a really tough journey. And I remember in my first week of being introduced to them and teaching them, I was actually, I'm not ashamed to say, I would cry on the phone to my stepdad, who is a teacher, and say, please help me, I don't know how I'm going to do this. Because in the beginning they were so well behaved, because that's how they normally are. They're so respectful of the process of learning and also respectful of teachers that they would never ever misbehave. And it was almost like their little personalities were kind of shut down and they'd just be very prim, very proper. And there was absolutely no laughing, and I'd try and crack jokes and they would just not find them funny at all. And it took a long time, but actually they're just, you know, being really gentle with them, getting them to trust me before they started to open up and their personalities started to come out, and then you realise they're absolutely hilarious.
Where will we see you next? That's why, having seen so much of you, I want to see you again. I want more.
I am doing something next, but I can't really talk about it at the moment. So
here or America?
Here or America? I don't know which. Right. I don't know which. It'll be a nice film, but I don't know where they're going to shoot it. So,
Naomi, lovely to see you. And best of luck with whatever the secret film is next.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to Naomi Harris there. She can be seen in Justin Chadwick's The First Grader from Friday the 24th of June across the UK. Definitely from The First Grade, I'm joined by Guardian critic and writer-at-large Zan Brooks. Zan, welcome back to the
welcome,
pod.
Welcome, right out of remedial class.
Okay, we'll be reviewing, nevertheless, if you can, The Green Lantern, The Beaver, Bad Teacher, Potiche, The Messenger, so many films out this week. But we'll start with The Green Lantern, because it is the superhero blockbuster of the week. It stars Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively. Is she?
How? Oh my God, Hal!
How did you know it was me?
What do you mean? I've known you my whole life! I've seen you naked! You don't think I would recognize you because I can't see your cheekbones? What is this? Why is your skin green? Why are you glowing? What the hell is with that mask?
Came with the outfit. Cool, huh?
Is that a superhero movie based on a comic I've never read? Have you?
But this is not news, is it, Jason? Which superhero comics have you read?
Spider-Man.
You've read Spider-Man, and that's why you like the films.
Yeah, exactly.
And you don't like any of the others.
Because I've read the comics.
And normally I'm in the position where I'm sort of defending these films, basically defending them in the guise of my 10-year-old self.
Yeah, but did he read The Green Lantern?
I think I did, but not religiously.
Okay.
And weirdly, you know, I think we had this conversation a couple of weeks ago with the X-Men movie, which I was like, you know, it's not too bad. This, I think, was the superhero movie too far for me.
Really?
I kind of reached critical mass with this one. And now I've decided that I hate all superhero movies.
Do you think that the public will kind of concur with you?
If I didn't think that, I wouldn't be in this job, basically. I think they should. And I think they will. I didn't really like this very much.
Why not?
It's, oh God, it was sort of done with, it's kind of full of mystical mumbo jumbo, basically. But that's fine if you treat the mystical mumbo jumbo seriously. And in this case, you know, what I didn't realise going into it is that we're basically overseen by a brotherhood of intergalactic warriors who are the protectors of sort of peace and goodness.
Did you not know that?
I didn't know that, but now I know it and I just sort of don't care. And I think that's crucial because you should care about these things. If this is true, we should at least believe that it's true and care. I didn't really care.
Right, Ryan Reynolds gets kind of chosen by
he's like the sort of the top gun, isn't he?
He's very much his top gun.
The cocky top gun who's the first humanoid ever to be inducted into the Brotherhood of Green Lanterns or whatever it is.
That's correct. Yeah. That is exactly that is what right, happens okay. to. He gets chosen by a ring, a man comes to Earth, Mark Strong. It took me a long time. What I did enjoy this was trying to work out who was under the prosthetics.
Yeah,
exactly. It was Mark Strong. And actually, it's a default answer. Like in the old Trivial Pursuit, if you just used to say Zed cars, you were right. Just say Mark Strong. You're usually right, especially in a Warner Brothers movie. And this one, he plays as some guy who's kind of cast off. I mean, there's a little Paradise Lost kind of element to it, as there always is in these things.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I quite like The Green Lantern. Oh, you know, I hate superhero movies.
I think this is telling, isn't it?
And I thought this was thoroughly all right, this film.
Why did you like it?
Well, I just thought it was all right. You know, it was just people flying and there was special effects for the right reasons. And
Was it the right reasons?
Yeah, because they were saving people. None of these things make much sense to me at all. And I just thought this was okay, really. I mean, I quite like Ryan Reynolds. He's kind of befuddled enough.
I quite like Ryan Reynolds. I liked him much more in Buried.
Buried,
last
he was very
year.
Good, yes.
Here, I thought he was a little bit underpowered for all of his kind of
he has more
rippling
power
body armour.
Than you could probably wear. He's very ripped, isn't he?
He's very ripped and he's got a ring.
Yeah.
A magical ring. It's like that Tolkien story, isn't
it? Do you know what? I didn't love it enough to argue its case.
But that's what you're doing right now.
Yeah, but I thought it was all right. I don't like X-Men. It's stupid. That this Green Lantern is...
This is stupid.
Yes, of course it's stupid.
And this has a sort of... I don't know. It felt like a bit contemptuous. It was just all kind of like...
Tim Robbins. I'll tell you why I liked it. It's Peter Sarsgaard.
Oh, I like Peter Sarsgaard.
Who is so becoming Malkovich. It is untrue.
Yeah, he is really good. And he at least strikes the right note of kind of camp insouciance.
Yeah,
I think sort of the mad scientist.
And there's a bit where he kind of becomes encephalitic and gets a big bald forehead.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it is literally he is becoming John Malkovich.
He is, isn't he?
So shall we move on to another superhero, Mel Gibson?
I thought you were talking
He's
about the beaver.
He's my hero. He is the beaver, and the beaver is a superhero as well, in a film directed by Jodie Foster in which manic depressive Walter Black, played by Mel Gibson, returns to his family after being thrown out by Jodie Foster. This time, he's got a beaver hand puppet on his arm. Do you think a charm will work?
The person who handed you this card is under the care of a prescription puppet. Designed to help create a psychological distance between himself and the negative aspects of his personality. Please treat him as you normally would, but address yourself to the puppet. Thank you.
There you go.
Is this some kind of a joke?
No, hardly, love. Nothing funny about it.
Stop it with the puppet, right? I'm confused, Walter, and I need some answers right now.
He said if I stick with it, that maybe could stop.
Who said that?
Dr. Macy.
Dr. Macy, you quit seeing him.
Well, I went back.
So this is some kind of a program?
I'll fill that one. Yes, Meredith, the answer is yes. That is exactly what it is. I know it seems radical. But
that was Mel Gibson and the beaver, or it could have been Ray Winston.
Well, this is it. He's definitely channeling Ray Winston from the Narnia films, isn't he, where he played Mr. Beaver. I think that must
that
be where
must
it
be
comes.
Where it comes from.
But there's also.
Do you think he kind of went right? My career's in ruins. I really need to resurrect it. I'm going to look up who has played beavers before.
Yeah, well, he did his research, didn't he?
Yeah.
He said who's been the ultimate beaver. It's been Ray. And you think you can't top it, therefore imitate it.
Is that your favourite cinematic beaver?
My favourite cinematic beaver is always Ray. That's always my, you know, when they call me You know, I'm always getting the phone
for the
calls.
List of those yeah, 10 beavers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 10
Mine is the one in The Naked Gun, which where Leslie Nielsen looks up at Priscilla Beauty Presley beaver. And says, nice beaver. And she says, thanks, I just had
the stuff. But that's not a talking beaver, though, is it? It's... Well,
you know. You can say more. You can say more in silence sometimes.
So that's
cinema.
Your kind of Buster Keaton of beavers.
It is, absolutely.
I think we're getting a bit
sidetracked. At least we haven't made beaver jokes, particularly.
Not
ones.
Yet.
Can you make a joke out of this film? Should it have been a comedy? Is it a comedy? What's going on?
Well, I think that's the problem with the film, that it doesn't know what the hell it's doing, and it sort of dithers, and in dithering with this material, it falls really badly flat on its face. It's flopped in America already. Jodie Foster, who directs and also has a kind of non-part as Mel Gibson's wife in this, says that it flopped because it's what she calls a dramedy and that Americans don't really understand dramedy.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of partly true, but it really doesn't know what it's doing.
How would dramedy work?
You've got these black as pitch themes in here. It's a film about depression. It's a film about suicide and about self mutilation and madness, I guess. And yet it's framed as this sort of awful, icky, jaunty, sentimental sitcom, and those things just don't work. And I guess what you've also got is what the beaver is kind of pointing to is this sort of elephant in the living room, which is Mel Gibson's off-screen histrionics, his anti-Semitic outbursts, his alcoholism. And we're kind of invited to consider that when we're watching this film. But it's too coy to properly address it.
Should we bring that extraneous baggage onto the screen?
Yeah, because if you're making a film like this, that's what you're doing.
I think he made this before he was officially an anti-Semite.
He was made it after he was officially an anti-Semite. He made it before he was officially... a racist on the phone to his wife.
Oh, I see.
Inviting her to blow him.
Yeah. Now, this is charming. A performance that perhaps... Do you think if, say, Jim Carrey was in this film and he was kind of a manic kind of guy possessed by a beaver, who's, you know, his hand was the beaver, that might have worked? There would have been a bit more frantic comedy.
It might have done, but I almost think if you're going to make a film like this, have, like, non-stars in it. Just do it completely, almost flat.
Yeah, don't see Jodie Foster's Beaver. Instead, maybe you'd like to see Potiche, which is the new film by François Ozon, he of Five Times Two and Eight Women, reuniting here with Catherine Deneuve. Here is Catherine Deneuve, the trophy wife of the title, making breakfast for her husband, Fabrice Lucchini, who says this really isn't her place.
Tu m'amèneras une fois?
Au badaboum?
Oui.
Tu es folle. C'est ta place.
C'est pas ma place à la cuisine, c'est pas ma place au badaboum. Elle est où, ma place?
Arrête de poser des questions, idiote.
Tu n'as pas trop bu, au moins?
Oh, fous-moi la paix, Suzanne.
Tu sais ce qu'a dit ton médecin?
Je sais ce que j'ai à faire!
She ends up taking over the Umbrella Factory in what is a farce from François Ozon. I suppose he's done this before. He does like theatrical films. He did a Fassbinder play called Water Drops on Burning Rocks, made a film with that. Eight Women had this kind of theatricality, campness to it. I kind of like him when he's on this sort of form. Did you go with it?
I did, and I always think that I'm not going to. I remember that I had the same feeling with Eight Women, where you think this is a sort of Doll's House musical where they all break into song every now and then. And I thought, that's just the hardest sell. There's no way I'd like it. And I thought it was wonderful. And this, again, it's like a pastiche of the 70s sitcom, really. It's based on an old farce by, I think, Pierre Barillet and Jean-Pierre Grady.
His work you often see on the boulevards.
Yeah, I think they wrote Green Lantern as well. And it's riffing off that. It's basically poking fun at it. It's parodying it, but it's doing it with great affection and a kind of authenticity as well.
Split screen, kind of Charlie's Angels hair, kind of
sort of kitsch design.
Music, yeah.
And he's having fun with this. And if he was a less good director, that would put too much of a distance between you and the story. And it would be fun for like 5 minutes and then get incredibly wearing. But there's not a foot wrong in this film, and all the actors are completely on song. They know exactly what they're doing, and you're just sort of swept up in the kind of exuberance of it.
Is there any more to it than just a pastiche of 70s kind of styling, though?
No, I think possibly not, but it's almost that the medium is the message. The style is the substance of this film.
But there is a story in which Catherine takes over the factory and starts kind of being like running it better than the men.
Yes, exactly. But that's all. It's all completely knitted into the fabric of this film. And it is a film about, you know, the gender wars and unreconstructed sort of macho behaviour back in the 70s, where her husband is this little kind of pocket tyrant who runs the Umbrella Factory and then has a heart attack when the workers start rebelling, and then enter sort of Gérard Depardieu as the socialist kind of hulking local mayor. And Catherine Deneuve, obviously, you know, having fun here, I think, in a way that we very rarely see her. I mean, at least since the last Ozon film she was in. You know, she's known as this kind of great regal presence in French cinema. And here she shows that she can do comedy.
Yeah, I think she's very funny in it. I like the film very much. Indeed, it did sweep me along. I could see that it might get overstretched, but there is a légère de main that is displayed here by François Ozon. And I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I've seen it twice, actually. Does get better second time around.
Does it now? Yeah, because it was at Venice, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Zan, a couple of years ago, if you were looking at the Best Actor nominations, they should have seen Woody Harrelson on there for a supporting Oscar nomination for a film called The Messenger. We never saw that film until this week. He plays a sergeant who delivers the terrible news to people about the death of their children in action. Casualty Notification, it's called, and he does it accompanied by Ben Foster.
What you actually need to do is pretty simple. Read the guidebook. Learn the script. Stick to the script. Fill in the blanks from the casualty report. Can you do that?
Yes, sir.
Can you look at me when I speak with you? Much appreciated. Never say stuff like lost or expired or passed away. Things people misunderstand.
Also stars Samantha Morton there as one of the people who gets bad news. This was a film that I think is one of those films about the Iraq War, the coming home kind of aspect of it. None of the films about the Iraq War were very successful in American cinema. Does this one kind of seize any ground back?
Yes, it is. I mean, this is one of a crop of coming home films. There was In the Valley of Ella, the Paul Haggis film, and there was Brothers a few years ago.
Jim Sheridan.
Both of which I thought were quite good.
Yeah, I like them both.
But both of which I think failed with audiences. And you know, maybe it's too close to home. Maybe it's just not the right time to be kind of making these films. And if you want escapism, then you're not going to want to see what you've been watching on CNN that evening. This, I think, is probably destined to meet the same fate. I mean, I think it was at Sundance 2 years ago. And then obviously, as you were saying, Woody Harrelson was Oscar nominated. So there's this sense that it's a kind of embarrassing, dirty secret that they're just trying to kind of shovel out without us quite noticing, which is a shame because I think it's very, very good. It's directed by a first-time director called Oren Moverman.
This I'd never seen, heard of him before.
Who I think was a journalist and has scripted I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan biopic, Jesus' Son, which I thought was a really underrated film from about 10 years
Alison
ago.
Alison Anders directing, with Samantha Morton in as
well. Yeah, Samantha Morton was in that too. And it's a good, serious film that treats its characters with real kind of compassion and yet with a kind of clear-eyed gaze. It's not sentimental at all.
Not at all. And I mean, in fact, people aren't what you think they are at all. I mean, Ben Foster, who I think is a very underrated actor, very good, actually, and he is very strong here as a kind of a live wire, if you like, let loose. And in a sense, this is a much harder task than being a war hero on the ground in foreign action. Actually kind of bringing this news home is the toughest assignment he's had.
Yeah, you're the kind of storm crows, aren't you? Kind of arriving in these little suburban streets and knocking on the door, and there's a protocol that you do, and you mustn't have physical contact. You can't kind of get too close to these people. And of course he does with the Samantha Morton character, who's the sort of the recently bereaved widow who he starts a romance with. And then you've got the great Woody Harrelson performance, which is fully deserved of an Oscar nomination, where he's a recovering alcoholic. And both of these men, you feel, are shouldering this great kind of burden of responsibility, but are pretty fragile themselves. And at some point, one of them is going to fall over.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a very subtle piece, I thought, and very surprising piece. None of the people in it were as you expect them to be, and the plot wasn't as you expected to be. I mean, Samantha Morton, again, is one of those actresses you never quite know what you're going to get from
great.
Her. She's terrific,
brilliant.
Really, because she's not sort of a slatternly or vulnerable. She's a very strong character.
No, she's a completely rounded character. Same goes for Steve Buscemi, who plays the bereaved dad.
Oh, yes, a cameo from Buscemi.
Yeah, and does, you know, he's hardly in it, but he makes the sort of the absolute most of sort of two scenes, basically. It's a sort of episodic film. It we're making it sound like it's a very kind of tightly plotted little morality play, but it's got a kind of an airiness and a sort of limberness to it that you don't really know where it's going.
Yeah, it sort of drifts through almost cliches as well. There's a small scene where he's in what has become shorthand for the emptiness of Western existence, the supermarket shelf with the Muzak. It's a thing we've seen in The Hurt Locker, for example. When you get home, you have all these choices of sauces and
cultures. Recently in Something About Kevin as well.
Supermarket. And it's almost that is just what. But I thought we'd get a whole scene there. It's just him drifting down the aisle very quietly, and it's a film that kind of creeps up on you. And but by the end leaves you in sort of very, very mysteriously. It's as if it never happened to you. It's a film that I thought was a bit of a dream. I was very, very moved by Orrin Moverman's work.
I thought it was great, and it's a small film, but it's definitely worth checking out.
That's The Messenger. Zan, I shall just leave you with a bad teacher, which is Cameron Diaz being a bad teacher.
When I first started teaching, I thought that I was doing it for all the right reasons. Shorter hours, summers off, no accountability.
Oh, I love my summers. Fresh corn.
From now on, my full-time job is finding a guy who's going to take care of me.
God, I pray for that.
You know, I spent my entire summer hanging out at bars near where the Bulls practice. I had some fun, got some cool souvenirs, but those guys are not looking to settle down. I mean, they all wear condoms, then they take the condoms with them. That's how paranoid they are.
Yeah, ugh, yeah. You're gonna find someone great. You are.
I've been thinking about it a lot. I'm like an 8, 8.5. But if I got a new pair of tits, right?
You don't want to do that. You're already so pretty.
You have no idea how difficult it is to compete against these Barbie doll types.
That was Cameron Diaz explaining to why she's in the teaching game.
Yeah. That's why they're all in the teaching game. All the right reasons.
For her new set of breasts, for short, long vacations, shorter hours.
Shorter skirt.
And also to be able to use casual drug use while giving the class a video to
Michael
watch.
Michael Gove's got to sort this woman out.
We could probably do with more like her. There's all sorts of... She always puts on films like Dangerous Minds and Stand and Deliver. So this is how teaching should be.
Yeah.
But then, of course, she does got to get better. And there's a part by Jason C. Eagle, who's always in these films at the moment. He's the kind of nice guy, kind of doofus, who kind of is the gym teacher here, and he kind of gets... There was the kind of the new shorthand for the director. They're not nerdy.
Yeah.
They're kind of nice, but they don't kind of respond.
But they're sort
to
of the schlubs.
They're schlubs, and they kind of eventually get the girl just by kind of sticking it out and being quite nice. This is quite funny, this film.
Yeah.
It's not as funny as Bridesmaids coming up next week, which is being
like
heralded as a classic, which has made me laugh a lot. This is sort of sub-Bridesmaids, but for comedies, it's really not bad as well. And Cameron Diaz, I'm very fond of. I think she's a really good comedian. And she's shown off to very good effect here.
Is this a sort of franchise thing with Bad Santa, or is it totally...
Well, you've got your bad ones, Bad Santa, Bad Teacher, then you've got the good ones like The Good Girl,
Good the Bad
good
and the
Shepherd,
Ugly.
Good Shepherd, Good Bad and the Ugly, Goodness Gracious Me.
That was the mashup, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. Jennifer Aniston is in The Good Ones, and Cameron Diaz is in Bad Ones.
But
bad.
You like the bad, don't
I like
you?
Bad.
Yeah, you've always been drawn to the bad.
And that's it, and that's why I have you on the show, Zan. Absolute pleasure to have you back on. Well, Zan, before you go, I must just ask, you can play along with us, because we've got a competition to win a film, Sound It Out, that we saw at the Sheffield Documentary Festival, and they've given us the actual film to win, which is brilliant of them. All we were asking our listeners to do is email us in where they bought their first vinyl record and what that record was, and I just thought maybe you've done this in the past.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you always wish you'd had the benefit of hindsight to come up with something really, really great that stands the test of time. And I think the first one, I'm not entirely sure, but I think the first one I bought was The Jam's last album, The Gift, which I bought, I think, probably in Woolworths in Frome in Somerset when I would have been like 12, 13, something like that. And I don't think I've listened to it in about, you know, close on 30 years.
Well, perhaps it's time to go
home. Maybe it is, yeah.
Dust it off.
Okay.
What's on the last album, the last Jam album?
Wasn't it sort of Beat Surrender?
Beat Surrender is excellent.
Yeah. And The Bitterest Pill, I like that. I'm going to go and listen to it.
Go listen to The Gift, Zan. I'm glad we've helped you remember these things. For more of Zan's musings on the world of film or music, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Well, alongside Zan Brooks, who was not allowed to enter the competition for reasons of fair play, we had loads of entries. Thank you very much for them all. All wanted to win a copy of Jeannie Finlay's Sound It Out documentary, which we spied at the Sheffield Documentary Festival. The interview is on last week's Film Weekly. What we wanted to know was, what was the first vinyl record you bought and where did you buy it? We had loads of entries, and I've got a winner. I have got a winner. The coin of destiny has been thrown and flipped and rolled onto Andrea McGuinness. Congratulations, Andrea. She says that her first vinyl was World Cup Willie, the 1966 World Cup song by Skiffle King Lonnie Donegan. And she bought it at Casa Disco in Barnsley. She gives a quote from the song. "He's as tough as a lion and will never give up. That's why Willie is favourite for the cup." Who can forget that? And they won as well. Andrew, you'll be pleased to know that Lonnie Donegan features very heavily in the brilliant We Need to Talk About Kevin, directed by Lynn Ramsey, that was at Cannes as well. A little bit of extra info for you. But thank you for that World Cup, Willie. It's a brilliant vinyl piece to have. I hope you still got it. It's probably worth a fortune in its unexpurgated form. You win a copy, however, of Sound It Out by Jeannie Finney. It's on its way to you. We had loads of brilliant entries, people reminding us of their vinyl that they bought. Richard Childs bought Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding from Double Four Records in Stockport, a shop that he says sounds very much like Sound It Out, and I'm sure it does. Ivor Moosom, he bought The Clash's Should I Stay or Should I Go at Rocky Plate Bar in Tromsø, Norway. And we've only had an entry even from Jack Williams Blake, who says his first vinyl was Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. Brilliant record. He bought it at Sound It Out Records. So there we go. There are many, many more. I wish I could delve into all your memories, including some guy who bought Adam Ant's Goody Two Shoes. Oh, yes, it is. James Amner. He says, the first single I bought was Goody Two Shoes by Adam Ant from R Price in Southend. Fair enough. He says he recently saw Adam Ant picking up hundreds of raspberries he'd knocked onto the floor of a supermarket. Crushed. We do competitions all the time here on Film Weekly. To join us and be part of the fun and be in with a chance of winning one of these wonderful prizes we offer up so regularly, just join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans. That's us. Be part of the conversation.
Yes.
What?
Oh.
What the day is?
Yes,
it?
I like to move it, move it.
You know?
This is the best day of my life.
This is Kathmandu, Nepal. I have been 190 countries so far.
The sad part is I spent all day long hoping for something amazing to happen, something great, something to appreciate this day and to be a part of it and to show the world that there's something great that can happen every day of your life and everyone's life.
Everything you heard there was recorded on July the 24th last year, 2010. It was sent in for inclusion in Life in a Day, a project overseen by British filmmaker Kevin MacDonald, who then edited down tens of thousands of clips posted on YouTube to craft a 90-minute feature that ambitiously tried to sum up life on this planet as lived on July the 24th, 2010. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the man who wielded the director's godlike power to create life itself. Kevin MacDonald, welcome to Film Weekly.
Thanks for having me on.
Congratulations on Life in a Day. It's a big thing, life, to sum up in 90 minutes.
94 minutes.
Well, that's why you need the extra four, you see.
Well, it's not summing up life. It's a slice of life. It's taking the temperature of the patient on a particular day, you know, this 24th of July, randomly chosen, pretty much. And I think what it does is it doesn't include every aspect of life, but it includes a lot of the major ones, a lot of the things that all of us are going to go through in our life, you know, whether that be being born, whether that be falling in love, whether that be being involved in some terrible accident.
Yeah, cleaning your teeth.
Whether that be political repression, whether that be poverty or richness, whether that be illness or death.
Did you know what life would entail when you asked the question? And really, you asked the world a question and it answered you.
Yeah, no, that was the fascinating thing about this. And, you know, as a director, you're used to at least pretending to yourself that you wield some control and authority. In this instance, I had none at all of either of those things. And so, you know, I just had to sit on my hands and watch as the material rolled in. We gave people a week to send stuff in. And it was kind of fascinating just to let the material speak to you and to try and actually pull out the strands of connections and the kind of the themes that seem to be in there inherently.
Everyone sort of starts the day. I mean, your film starts with the moon. Obviously, there's a lot of people kind of shooting at the moon. It seemed to me. Was it a special day for the moon?
It was a full moon. And that was a piece of serendipity. We didn't know that it was a full moon. And then we just started to get all of this stuff coming in with moons. And that seemed like a beautiful way to start it. You know, we're all together under the full moon. The moon is full everywhere on Earth on the same night.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but it clearly is
from your
film. Yeah,
funnily enough, I didn't know that either. There you go. But then I looked up where these clips were from, and they were from Malawi, and they were from, you know, Australia, New Zealand, and Indonesia, North America, and South America. And so you start to think, well, that's a great metaphor, actually. And so that was sort of how we how he went about making the film, actually. It was just, you know, listening to what the material had to say. And, you know, the same with the ending. We found the ending. It's just a beautiful, beautiful clip in America. A girl sitting in her car, lightning and thunder going off behind her. And it's 1 minute to midnight, and she's saying, I've had such a boring day. Mm. Nothing interesting ever happens to me. And I just want to be heard. I want to be listened. I want to count. I want to mean something. I want my life to mean something. And it was such a beautiful clip. And she was such a extraordinary kind of actress in a way, in the way she presented it, that we thought, that's the end.
Now, it's very interesting because, it, in fact, your film actually kind of focuses on what is interesting. She, of course, thinks her nothingness is not worthy. But once you put a camera on it, once it's put on the big screen, once it's part of your film, it becomes interesting, as does people making toast, people cleaning their teeth, people going to the toilet. Mm-hmm. Everything is interesting for a moment, isn't it? That's what I discovered watching your film.
Well, I think that one of the origins of this whole idea was back in the 1930s and 40s, the mass observation movement, which did a similar thing to this, but using diaries, you know, good old-fashioned pencil and paper.
So Humphrey Jennings, was he?
Humphrey Jennings is one of my great documentary heroes. He was one of the originators of that, one of the three originators. And what they were trying to do back then was to say, you know, what seems to us mundane and boring, actually, when you look at the detail of it, is kind of fascinating and bizarre and weird and sometimes a little bit surreal. And that's sort of where the impulse for making the movie came from, to get that, you know, to say, well, brushing your teeth is a kind of boring, mundane thing that we all do. But actually, when you see, you know, 6,000 people brushing their teeth all around the world at the same time, it becomes something really kind of bizarre.
Yeah, I was sort of one joins in the brotherhood of it as well. It's like, well, I brush my teeth as well. It's something that we all have in common with it, and it made me question why we do it as well. I mean, everyone does it. I mean, yeah. It just seems bizarre. How can we all suddenly brush our teeth? Where did that originate?
It didn't happen 100 years ago. And even I love the fact that even later on in the film, you come back to a guy in some tiny village in northern India, and there he is with a stick which he's brushing his teeth with holding a couple of sort of white cows, with a couple, you know, sari clad women in the background, and he's got this stick and he's brushing his teeth with it.
No, I thought that was delicious too. I wondered what you learnt about life, because I mean, you're a director, as you say, you're godlike, you tend to storyboard a little bit and tend to expect something as you're going along. What did you learn that made you go, oh, that surprised me about life?
Well, I think just it's a good lesson to anyone, actually, to sort of to have this experience of just not being in control, to actually letting the material speak to you rather than the other way around, and then thinking, what can I do with that? You know, what is the hidden film? What is the sculpture hidden in this big pile of stones that I can pull out?
So it's a wonderful editing job.
I mean, the film is really a collaboration between myself and the editor, Joe Walker, and it's not a film where you can say the director's role is any more important than the editor's role. In fact, his role is probably, you know, he certainly put a lot more hours in than I did, as he said.
I mean, I'm quite pleased to notice, because I mean, we had Asif Kapadia on couple of weeks ago from Senna, a film which he's the director of, in which he never wielded the camera for an instant. He didn't didn't shoot a single frame. Yeah. Presumably that's the same.
I was one of the producers on that film.
Well, there you go. So you're the father of this new, I suppose, new wave of documentaries where the director actually never uses his camera at all.
Well, it's still direction. I mean, actually, it's not really, of course, that new. It's going right back to the 1920s, even. There was a woman called Esther Shub in Russia who was Eisenstein's editor, and she made a whole series of propaganda films using the Romanov family's home movies. And of course, that's the same thing. You're taking this found footage and you're making it say what you want it to say. You're giving it some kind of meaning that it was never really intended originally. And that's sort of what we're doing. So there's an honourable kind of tradition of using archive or found footage to make movies. It just so happens, though, that this footage was all created for us and was all shot on the single day. That's the thing that makes it different. And that's the thing that could only be done now, because I think that it is true to say, and it sounds a bit grandiose, but this is a film which is kind of unique because it can only really be made in the last few years since the rise of YouTube, since the rise of the internet.
All life is there. It's a beautiful collage. It's called Life in a Day. Kevin McDonald, congratulations on a whole new realm of documentary making. Humphrey Jennings, I think, would have been proud.
Thank you very much, Jason.
And Kevin McDonald's Life in a Day is to be found in cinemas from the 17th of June. That's this Friday across the UK. My thanks to all my guests this week, to Kevin McDonald and to Naomi Harris. The beautiful music we've been using this week is some of those African instrumentations from the soundtrack to The First Grader, written by Alex Hefes, who often combines with Kevin McDonald in his films as well. It all comes together here on Film Weekly. Do buy a copy of The Observer this Sunday. I'm sitting in for the great Philip French for this week, so all the films that are out this week are reviewed by me. There's a lot of work to be done this week, but I'm happy to do it. I'll be seeing you next week too, but from now, from me on Film Weekly, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.